the Royal Australian Air Force in person, 1921 to 2021. Ad Astra Aviator. This is a series of podcasts recounting the personal stories of veterans and their families. The narrator is Gareth McRae, OAM.
Well, as we continue our history of the Royal Australian Air Force over the last 100 years, for a little while, I'd like to spend some time in Coffs Harbour. Today, it's Richard Neil Kellaway, AM, Group Captain. Richard, on his entry into the RAAF, flew fighters, both Sabre and also Mirage. In October 1968, he was posted to Vietnam as a forward air controller with the United States Air Force, flying the O-1 Bird Dog. After further time flying Mirages in Butterworth and then flying instruction, he was posted to the 442nd Tactical Fighter Squadron, USAF, Nellis Air Force Base on F-111As. Following this, he became an F-111C aircrew instructor at Amberley. He then completed RAF Staff College and became Staff Officer to Deputy Chief of Air Force. He then had a succession of postings, Commanding Officer of No. 1 Flying Training School, Personnel Plans Officer, Air War College with the United States Air Force, Director of Trainer Aircraft Project, Director of Studies, Joint Services Staff College. He had a change of pace between 1989 and 1994 and joined the Department of Prime Minister and Australian Development Assistance Bureau. This led to private consultancy work specialising in Aboriginal community development. Richard's reflections say he is more a thinker than a doer. He likes being at the vanguard of organisational change. Richard has said in his autobiography, "I sense intuitively the need for change, and my mind winnows possible pathways of change from the complexities in the organisational environment. As a change agent, I'm committed to participatory change, but reflexively pragmatic." Well, Richard, it is a great pleasure to be able to chat to someone in Coffs Harbour. Former RAAF personnel, you've retired comfortably, have you?
Very, very comfortably indeed, Gareth. Yes, it's a lovely location.
Manly Boys High offered flying scholarships back in the late 50s, 1958. Tell us how that came about. What was involved?
Yes, it was through the air training corps. So it was actually the air training corps flight at Manly Boys High School that was offering the scholarships. And of course, they were in competition with all of the other public and private schools. So that year, there were 10 flying scholarships awarded, and yours truly was fortunate enough to have won one of those.
So you were therefore in the air training corps, the ATC, at Manly Boys High.
That's correct, yes. At that stage, I think I was a sergeant and ultimately ended up as the cadet under officer in fifth year. And it was across that period, that 2 years, that I had the flying scholarship, got the private pilot's license before a year and a half before I could get a driver's license. And I think back now to the faith that was being placed on these callow youths who wandered out to aeroplanes and managed to get themselves airborne and safely back on the ground to the at the pleasure of Illawarra Flying School.
Yeah, Richard, just before we leave the school, how difficult was it to balance the leaving certificate year and also the requirements of your position with the ATC?
It apparently wasn't too hard at all, because I failed maths too and had to do a reset so that I could go into the academy at the start of 1962.
Did the school also have an army cadet unit as well?
Yes, had army, but no navy.
Why did you choose ATC as opposed to Army while you were at school? What was the motivation?
Okay, a very good question. Apparently, Mum and Dad tell me that as a little tacker in my crib, when an aeroplane flew overhead, I raised my finger and looked skyward. So apparently it was a very, very early attraction. But in latter years, I came across Dad's logbook and then subsequently went to the National Archives and asked for his service records. And in 1939, he wrote to the Air Force saying, "I would like to be a pilot, please accept me." He wasn't accepted, joined the militia, went on to join the AIF, served in Papua New Guinea at Milne Bay, then up at Buna and Gona, contracted malaria and came back to Australia on rehabilitation, left the Army, joined the Air Force and graduated, got his wings, but the war in Europe ended before he was able to start or about to start his Liberator conversion. And I think in retrospect, without really knowing this, Dad's intention was to go into civil aviation after the war in the airlines, and he figured that while he was offered fighters, bombers was going to be the more sure way of getting into the airlines. So there's a long history there, and if you I've read a little bit about epigenetics, so a long answer to your question, I think it was epigenetic.
Well, there you go. I've had a genetics lesson as well as an airlines lesson.
Wait, there's more.
There is more to come. 1962 through 1965, you're a cadet.
Just that's right.
Give us a paint a picture for us of what that was like, what was involved.
Okay. Well, the first 2 years were at the Air Force Academy, and my maths finally caught up with me, and I failed second year. But in retrospect, I would call it an almost monastic existence at the academy. Very, very well-intentioned senior officers and lovely human beings as well, I might add. But they brought to their inculcation of our values and attitudes those that had got them through the Second World War, and obviously they were survivors. The two senior officers both had been pathfinders, one a pilot, one a navigator, and they knew the seriousness of war and the consequences of loss. So the values that they inculcated were certainly strong, but the way in which they were inculcated was to, unlike the Navy and unlike the Army through their institutions, we were separated from society at Point Cook. I think we were allowed out in first year between 8:30 and we had to be on the bus back to Point Cook at 12:30 on a Saturday morning, and had to wear our uniform. In second year, I think we were allowed to graduate to our academy blazer, which was civvies, but again, the same restrictions. And it wasn't until third year or fourth year that you were allowed to socialise with the general public. So it was, in that sense, a very closed environment. Formed wonderful friendships, of course, and lifelong friendships as a result of that. On the other hand, at the end of second year, I was given the opportunity, because I failed, to go across to the basic flying training school and to go through pilot training. And in retrospect, again, I think I probably spent a lot of time in first year and second year looking out the window at the windjills that were flying flying over our quarters, and that probably didn't lend itself to graduating with the Bachelor of Science degree that otherwise I would have.
I would imagine, you having said that the people who were training you, the people above you, had come through World War II.
Yes.
I would suppose that puts your cohort of cadets into a very important position, in the sense that you actually were trained by people who had done it, rather than people who had joined and hadn't been in any war scenario at all.
Yes, there's a lot of truth in that, Gareth, but it was very, very subtly done. There really was no discussion of combat or of war. It was a subtle inculcation of values and attitudes, as I say, and dedication to service, of course, service of the community. Yes, you're right. And certainly looking at those men with a couple of rows of ribbons, DSO, DFC, AFC, that certainly meant a heck of a lot to young men. And to go back a little bit, I would have read Paul Brickhill's Reach for the Sky, the story of Douglas Bader. I'd have read that 12 times before I was 10 years of age. So I had, again, I'd inculcated in my own self this sense of chivalry, you know, the understanding of what fighter pilots did, you know, the joy of flying, I guess, and had experienced flying. By very shortly after, before I joined the Air Force. So there were many, many factors afoot, I guess, but these men with their DSO, DFC and AFC personified the chivalry and the attitudes and so on that I'd probably brought with me into the Air Force.
It's obviously stayed with you too, which is great to see. Did you also perchance read Biggles while you were under 10?
Yes, I did read Biggles too, and Ginger Lacey was my favourite.
Yeah, Ginger always struck my soft chord. Getting into the Sabre conversion. Mm. Take us. You've obviously you're a cadet to 65. What were the steps leading into that Sabre, and what was it like?
The only way to answer that sensibly is to say that the transition from the Vampire to the Sabre was like stepping out of an MGTC and jumping into a Cadillac. It was an extraordinary difference. You were by yourself right from word go. I remember that very first takeoff in the Sabre. It would have been in June of 1965. So it was midwinter and cold. And I remember catching my breath as I released the brakes, and I probably didn't breathe again until about 10,000 feet, which would have been probably at least a minute later, and probably more than that, probably a couple of minutes later. It was exhilarating.
Was the training on a Vampire, or was it something pre-Vampire?
No, we did about 120 hours in the windshield at Point Cook, and then another 120 hours in the Vampire dual seat at Pierce in Western Australia, and then another 60 or 80 hours in the dual Vampire learning the fighter pilot's craft.
When you were doing the Sabre conversions, is it right that you were also then part of the squadron, you were a squadron fighter pilot?
No, that came later. The operational conversion unit number 2, OCU, converted us to the aircraft and then taught us the very, very basics of being a fighter pilot. But we graduated to the squadron, and I went to number 76 squadron on the Sabre. We graduated as Category D fighter pilots. In other words, we had a lot of learning to do, and working with the senior pilots in the squadron and the fighter combat instructors, we learnt our craft progressively. But in my case, I didn't become a Cat A fighter pilot. That was 1965. I didn't become a Category A fighter pilot till end of 1970, pardon me.
So what other roles or duties, in addition to converting to the Sabre and going through those steps, what are other duties did you have leading up to and including 1968 before you left our shores?
Yes, I was very fortunate. I probably had two really good mentors that saw something in me that I didn't see. Jake Newham, who ultimately became Chief of Air Force, was the first at Fighter OCU. He was the Chief Flying Instructor. And for some reason or other, he asked me to, or gave me an order, I guess, but asked me whether I would mind being his execo. Completely informal secondary duty, but my responsibility was to basically manage his office for him, open the incoming mail, sort it for him, and as I say, that continued throughout the remainder of my Air Force. I think I worked for him another 4 times, maybe 5 times, and on all occasions, an inspirational man, just by his very manner, let alone his interest guiding. The other person, of course, was Ian Westmore, whom I ran across in the F-111, and that was in the 1970s. So sure. I probably have answered the question indirectly, but that was probably the major duty that I had in those years leading up to 1968.
So did that position then give you the opportunity? Did it open doors that otherwise would not have opened for you and led you a path that you may have not otherwise gone?
Look, I think the only way I can answer that sensibly, Gareth, is to say that it was subtle. It was unstated. It was an opportunity, which I, in truth, feel that I probably understood completely at that stage. But it was an opportunity, and I must have done what was expected of me, because it certainly didn't reflect badly on my career. The other thing I should mention was that leading up to 1968, we were given opportunities to do the ground liaison officers course with the army unit at Williamtown, and I did that, and that enabled me to become a forward air controller, and along with Ken Mitchell, whom you'll be talking to in the latter part of this day, we got involved in an army exercise out in the Putty Colo area, and while it was on the ground, that gave us some understanding of Australian Army ground operations, and that ultimately led to us both going to Vietnam as forward air controllers.
And that relationship across services today, I would imagine, is very important. Have you seen that? Did you see that start then and grow as the years went on?
Not only did I see it, but also was very much part of it. When we brought the F-111 back from America in 1973, and you remember that was the second time that an attempt was made to get the aircraft home, in 1973 I was a qualified flying instructor, and I had spent 20 months in the United States flying with the United States Air Force, instructing their aircrew on the F-111. So when I got back, I was instructing on the F-111, ultimately promoted to squadron leader and given the responsibility to re-look at the flying syllabus of training for operational crews. At that stage, we had focused very, very heavily on terrain following and ground strike, and obviously the aircraft had many, many capabilities way beyond that. So I introduced a range of other activities where we worked in close cooperation with Army, and introduced maritime strike, and did a lot of work with the Navy, including meeting at sea, rendezvousing at sea with A4s, and doing combined surface strike.
Awesome. Australia's involvement, or Vietnam, the issue of Vietnam started in 1962, slowly and gradually built. Now, you started as a cadet in 1962.
Yes.
You go to Vietnam in 1968. Before you actually get to Vietnam, what were you conscious of? What, as an Air Force personnel, what were you conscious of was happening overseas in Vietnam through those training years?
I must be naive or whatever, but I was oblivious really to what was happening. Obviously, I was aware that the Caribous had gone to directly to Vietnam from Canada on that first delivery flight. But apart from that, there was a war on, and no one really spoke about it. There was no preparation. And Ringo and I were talking about this last night, actually. Both of us surprised that there really was no conscious preparation for combat. All that we did was obviously had a focus in the delivery of weapons, the fighting air-to-air 1v1, 2v2, 4v4 aircraft versus aircraft, no dissimilar combat, but no one really focused on why we were doing that. It was just something you did, and that's what the program required you to do. So when my posting to Vietnam came, it was my duty. I was in the permanent Air Force. At that stage, I think I was still on a short service commission, but I was posted. It was what I did, what I wanted to do, and I simply went. And my poor wife at that stage was left to her own devices, effectively, for the 6.5 months I was away. And as one wag said many, many times, if the Air Force intended that you have a wife and family, they would have issued it to you. So again, these are sort of reflections, I guess, on the approach of the day to our duties. Yeah, really, it was the most hedonistic life that one could experience.
I've got to say, let's go back to the relationship between the Defence Forces and Navy, Army and Air Force. I mean, the Army's role in Vietnam, Battle of Coral Balmoral, Battle of Catan, Nui Dat, etc., etc.
Yes.
Very much the army. Can you give us a sense of a feeling of what the Air Force's role was, how the Air Force interacted? Paint a picture for the Air Force in Vietnam.
Well, my experience, of course, was as a forward air controller, and I was posted to work with the 442nd Tactical Fighter Squadron. I was posted to the crikey, I can't even remember the name of the squadron. Anyhow, it was that squadron in Vietnam, that United States Air Force squadron that employed the forward air controllers. I worked with two different units, the 3rd Brigade of the 1st Division, Big Red One, for 2 months. They then transitioned to the AV-10, and at that stage, Ken Mitchell went on to the AV-10. I stayed in the A-1. I was then posted to the 11th Armoured Cav Regiment, and they were an extraordinary outfit. They had their own organic air, so they had slick Hueys. They had Huey Cobras and LOH-6As Loaches. They also had tanks, APCs, and they had their own airborne platoon. Our role was to act as a strike force throughout the Three Corps area. I worked very, very closely with the light fire teams. That would be one or two Huey Cobras and one or two Loaches. We would go out every second day looking for active base camps.
Yep.
Then the next day, having found one, I'd direct the airstrikes or the artillery in preparation for either airborne insertion or insertion by tank and APC. And we worked extremely closely with them, totally integrated into their activities.
That is the USAF's Armoured Cavalry Regiment, is that correct?
This was the United States Army.
The Army.
11th Armoured Cav Regiment, that's right, yes, yep.
A silly question, what's a bird dog?
Cessna 01 bird dog. If you can imagine a little tail-dragging Cessna 180, like a Cessna 180, but with tandem seating rather than seat for four. So very small.
What was its role?
It was, as a forward air controller, to visual reconnaissance, obviously working with the light fire teams with the 11th Cav Regiment. We had 8 smoke rockets and 3 sets of radios, UHF, VHF and HF. So we acted as the airborne control centre. Once the battle had started, the ground commander, and in the case of 11th Armoured Cav Regiment, he was airborne in a Huey, slick Huey. He would hand over the command of the battle, control of the battle at least, to the forward air controller, and we'd act as the liaison between the troops on the ground and the fighters.
So in summary then, the Air Force had a very important role in the battles that took place in Vietnam.
We were totally integrated into the ground action, that's right, yes. Yep.
You talked about when you released the brake on the Sabre, holding your breath until you got to 10,000 feet. How long did you hold your breath when you got into the Mirage?
Well, I was very fortunate. We had duels in those days, so there was somebody in the back seat who I guess was the ultimate line of defence if I became ham-fisted. But my first flight was with Tazzy Carswell, one of the legends of the fighter world. We got airborne, and immediately after airborne, the pitch dampers failed. Not supposed to fly the aircraft with pitch dampers failed, but Tazzy was quite relaxed and allowed me to complete that initial flight with no pitch dampers. So I guess if there's...
Let me just pause you there. You better, for someone listening who may be thinking about Air Force but not in the air, what is a pitch damper?
A pitch damper is a control surface. It is a device that controls the elevators or the elevons and counteracts any movements of the aircraft that are uncommanded by the pilot. Okay, so if I'm flying and the aircraft does something that I haven't said I want you to do, the pitch damper opposes that. Does it with gyroscopes and electrics to the pneumatic.
So if they're not working, there are two people flying the plane, the Mirage and you.
That's right. The Mirage actually didn't do too bad a job. Yeah. And there's not a pilot anywhere in the world who's flown the Mirage who wasn't in love with it. It was truly the lady of the sky. Beautiful aircraft.
still is to you, your favourite?
I would think so. I really enjoyed flying the F-111. That was another Cadillac of the sky. But the Mirage was far more sophisticated than the MGTC that we learned to fly on. And it was like pulling on a pair of jogbas or jeans. It was a lovely tight cockpit. The engine was right behind you. It growled at you the whole time. But the aircraft was just enormously responsive, just beautiful.
Well, that's awesome. A great tribute to the, to the people that gave us the Mirage.
It was quintessentially French.
You go to Butterworth in 1970. In 1971, you were a flying instructor with Mackies. Now you're teaching. Tell us about that. What was that like?
I don't know how to describe it, Gareth, if that's not Irish. I enjoyed working with young people. I don't know how effective I was as a flying instructor, but just an enjoyable job working with young people, helping them come to master the things that they needed to do. Satisfying, definitely. Rewarding, definitely. Challenging, definitely.
To me, then, listening to what you say and what other people I've spoken, had the privilege of speaking to, you were taught by people who flew in Korea and maybe flew in World War II as well. Mm. They passed down their skills and their understanding, and however subtly, to you, you then pass it on. So there's a stream of connectivity runs across the Air Force from beginning 1921 to now.
Yes, that's certainly true, I think I've got to get down to the personal issues here. I'm a most unusual human being in terms of things like the Myers-Briggs typology. I'm one of 4% of the population live in the quadrant in which I live, and I'm 1%, one of those four quadrants. My mind and my personality, my being, are 1%, 99% atypical of the broader population. One of my senior officers doing an assessment of me annual report said I was a deep thinker, not an innovative one. And I think actually that's very, very apt. I tend to sit back and soak up, and do it subtly, but soak up issues in the environment and then find a way in which those issues can be combined to achieve an outcome. For example, going back to the F-111, it was obvious that the aircraft had the capabilities. The flying training syllabus at the time didn't explore those capabilities. Therefore, people were not prepared by the time they went to their squadron to exploit those capabilities. And it was only natural, therefore, that the syllabus should be rewritten and it should include those capabilities.
Stay with the F-111 and the F-111C and its role. Until you thought about it and suggested it, was it not included in maritime strike and reconnaissance and you wanted it included? Would that be an example of what you're saying?
Most certainly, but it wasn't that I wanted. It was obvious that it had the capability. The defence of Australia was going to depend on defence of the sea barrier, and therefore it was inevitable that the aeroplane and any other strike aircraft that we had was going to have to be used in that maritime strike role as the first line of defence for the country.
Up to that point, was it the best aircraft of all the air forces around the globe?
Without a doubt, it was an extraordinary aircraft, absolutely extraordinary. No other aircraft had the ground-hugging capability. The Tornado did, but it did. Tornado was a European aircraft without the range. It was just an extraordinarily capable aeroplane. Scared the daylights out of you, mind you.
In what way, Richard?
There was one night terrain following route that we used to fly, which came into the Point Lookout west of Coffs Harbour from the west. And Point Lookout to the east has this valley, which the aircraft, having reached Point Lookout, would then descend at 12,000 feet a minute into this valley, and the valley sides were close enough for the rotating beacon to illuminate the trees on either side. And the aircraft would take you within a couple of hundred feet of those trees on either side. So there you were, hurtling into the night, 12,000 feet a minute rate of descent, with very, very aware of the trees on either side as the aircraft was whizzing down into this valley.
Wow, I hear what you're saying. Is therefore, I suppose this is an unfair question, but given the geography of Australia, given the isolation of Australia, how far we are away from other areas, is it important that we consider purchasing aircraft that can take into account that distance, tyranny of distance.
Most certainly. And I don't think we would have any aircraft now with air refueling capability that wasn't able to project power well beyond the borders of Australia, the coast of Australia.
I see the United States appears quite frequently in your career. You worked with the Army in Vietnam, Armored Cavalry Regiment. You, between 1972 and 1973, with the 42nd Tactical Fighter Squad, United States Air Force again. And in 1984 to 1985, you were the Air War College with the United States Air Force. Your relationship with them is pretty good. What do you feel about them? What's our relationship with them like?
I've got to be honest. Progressively throughout my career, I became increasingly disenchanted with the American way of war. And to some extent, or in fact, to a large extent, Air War College topped that off. And if there's one simple way I could explain it, this is 1985, isn't it? So it was before the fall of the Soviet Empire, and the bumper sticker of choice was Russia sucks. And remember, this is Air War College, so it's the organization that's training the future generals. That's Air War College. And then below that, there's the course that's equivalent to our Staff College courses, training majors to be wing commanders or majors to be lieutenant colonels. That was the bumper sticker of choice. I ended up ducks of that course. There were 340 of us, and I managed to ducks that course, and also did a Master's of Political Science at the same time. So I gave myself a reasonable chance, and obviously the Air War College gave me a reasonable opportunity to exercise my mind. I therefore came to the conclusions I came to with a bit of forethought. It wasn't an emotional response to situation.
So how important is the fact that you have been described as a change agent, a person who thinks about a problem, sees a problem and comes up with a solution and tries to get it implemented? How important is that? Has that been to you and a career at the same time together in the Air Force?
It probably terminated my Air Force career, because change agents are a pretty rough fit in organizations that value stability I guess value stability in the full sense of the word. So a change agent, not a particularly easy course. And the PC-9 aircraft, of course, was a classic case in point. The terms, that was my last job in the Air Force, the terms of reference for that that aircraft were to identify the aircraft from the competitors that would maximise work for the Australian aerospace industry. The second term of reference, find the aircraft that will maximise follow-on work for the Australian aerospace industry. And the third was to find the aircraft that meets the air staff requirement. The PC-9 was the only aircraft that met all of those three, but it was not the solution that the Air Force wanted. But as a change agent, I could see that not only did it meet the terms of reference, but it could bring a completely new way of training. And at that stage, of course, the PC-9 offered the choice of either a glass cockpit or an old alphanumeric dial type cockpit. And I was given the opportunity, once the government made the decision on the recommendation of the team that I was part of, we put in the glass cockpit, and therefore prepared people for the Hawk and the other the Hawk and the F-35 and the F-18 that were going to come into service.
The Air Force must have had some faith in you. I mean, you were a group captain. You don't get the group captain unless you've got some sort of ability, surely.
That's certainly true, but there's a difference between ability, I think, and recognition of ability, and the risk associated with putting people who don't fit the mould easily in positions where they're changing the future. But very much to credit, the Air Force has certainly made use of that aeroplane, and to go on to purchase the PC-21 is an indication that the change was one that was seen as being worthwhile for the Air Force.
All right, so you've mentioned Ringo. Let's assume Ringo's grandson, who's maybe 15 years of age, comes to you one day and says, look, I don't want to ask my grandfather, Richard. Can you give me, in simple terms, Why should I join the Air Force?
I would think because it's going to be the most satisfying thing you'll ever do.
And what are my chances of branching out after I've left the Air Force after 20 years into other fields? How will the Air Force prepare me for that?
It'll give you opportunities for self-sufficiency. If you fly single-seat aircraft, it'll give you an opportunity for working intimately in a crew environment. If you fly crewed aircraft, it will give you access and operational experience with the most advanced technology currently available, and it'll give you experience of working across a wide variety of technical groups and human being phenotypes, and all of that prepares you very well for anything that comes subsequently.
Okay, you retire from the Air Force, Richard, and you go to work for the Department of the Prime Minister.
Mm.
Which Prime Minister would that have been?
That was Bob Hawke.
Bob Hawke?
Mm.
Did you get to interact with Mr. Hawke?
Most certainly. On many occasions, the staff officers from the Prime Minister's office would go up when, in my case, I was working on the South Pacific and International Development Desk. So any time anyone from the South Pacific or with a international development interest met the PM, then I'd be assigned to go across and take notes, and did that regularly.
Historically, your impression of him as Prime Minister?
He was... The band's dead now, isn't he? So I guess I can probably say he was as brash as his university days portrayed him to be. I remember being told that the most crass thing you can do to a South Pacific Islander is to put the soles of your feet towards them. And Bob, I know on at least one occasion, pulled his feet up onto the coffee table, lit up a stokey, and put his feet full face towards that dignitary. To say that I was horrified would be to understate the case, but it wasn't my position to correct him.
No, well, following working with the Department of Prime Minister, you did something else that's rather important. You worked with the Aboriginal Community Development Project. What was that involving, Richard?
Yes, I came across that serendipitously, I guess, after I headed up the Australian Overseas Development Cooperation Program in Papua New Guinea. I decided that the public service was not for me, but I could see that, I had a terrific interest in international development. So I realised that to get a leg in with international development as a private consultant, I'd need to do an MBA. So I did an MBA and ended up being offered a PhD scholarship at the end of that. So I started teaching as well as researching. And one of the people in one of the classes I was teaching was in Queensland Health and had responsibility for Palm Island. And she introduced me to the elders on Palm Island, and I started working on Palm Island as a consultant, and that led ultimately to my creating a private consultancy firm. I had three Aboriginal people and three other Caucasians working with me, and we worked in probably about 40 different Aboriginal community projects, probably predominantly in five communities. And the technique that I used was profoundly consultative. Participatory development was the issue that I was researching for my PhD, and we applied that, and it was really effective. It took a little while for the people to realise that our values valued their considerations and needs, we built up trust with them, which led to my research giving them the opportunity to express their really heartfelt needs and their desires, and through bureaucratic experience put out that in the language that bureaucrats needed. But and of course by this stage Kevin Rudd had become PM, and his Aboriginal Development Manifesto was very much along the lines that we were practicing. But unfortunately the bureaucracy, Departments of Health, Department of Indigenous Affairs and so on, were populated by people whose university studies indicated that there was only one way to deal with Aboriginal people, and that was to throw money at them, and that Aboriginal people could not understand what they needed. And ultimately, we were not able to, while we listed a trust, the trust was undermined by the response of the public service. And interestingly enough, in the last couple of years, many of the things that we were being told by the Aboriginal community, have now reached government, and government starting to realise that the things that they were doing were not producing the results communally or societally or individually that they were hoping would be achieved by putting that money to the communities.
So, Richard, I hope now, having said what you've just said, you can see the importance of the centenary of the RAAF making use of a change agent like you, because it needs people like you to actually unclog the wheels and unclog those things that stand in the way of progress. And it's because of people like you that have made the Royal Australian Air Force such a great institution as it is. So I want to thank you for your services and thank you very much for the privilege of being able to chat with you today. And I'll let you enjoy the vagaries of Coffs Harbour.
Thanks very much, Gareth. Been great talking to you.
Globally, the RAAF has between 500 and 700 people on operations every day, contributing to coalition operations, peacekeeping, and humanitarian and disaster relief. The RAAF takes pride in its service. It has a history of endeavour and sacrifice, which has won it a place in the hearts of all Australians and a position of respect among the armed services of all Australia's allies. The RAAF will never tarnish its record. It carries on in the proud tradition of Per Adua Ad Astra.
This is a series of podcasts recounting the personal stories of veterans and their families, produced by Air Force Association New South Wales, which is a registered charity that focuses on the well-being of Air Force veterans and their families. If you would like to donate funds to help us with this important work, you can search Air Force Association New South Wales in Google and go to our website.